So how you been?
I don't know, I just feel really tired.
Oh. Well, were you all happy and elate when Daft Punk won the Grammys?
I watched the Grammys, and then I think like the last 20 minutes, I was just like, fuck this, I'm tired.
Okay.
And so I didn't watch the ending.
No, I didn't watch any of them because I had no idea who was going to be on, and I'm sorry, most of the music that came out this year I wasn't a really big fan of. But when I saw that later on in the news that Daft Punk won the big awards and they were on stage, I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
That's
Yeah, most of it was like so dumb. The Taylor Swift thing.
yeah.
I'm so glad they made fun of it because it was so ridiculous to watch. I mean, oh God. Yeah, most of it was pretty bad.
No, I forget what Taylor Swift do.
She was like, okay, she like sang a song and she was like playing at the piano, and then at some point during the chorus, she just started like headbanging. And it looked really weird. Like she was trying too hard.
Oh, that's hilarious. Oh, funny. All right. Well, should we get going with the show?
Yeah.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this, our second episode of Silver Screen Speak. I am your host, The Vern, from The Vern's Video Vortex, and along with me today is the very lovely, beautiful, intelligent Christina Louie from Aftercut Reviews. Hello, Christina.
Hi.
I have to praise your name because you decided to be on this show a second time, and I'm very grateful for that.
My pleasure.
Yes. Now, for today's show, we want to give our listeners a little, I would say, movie lesson, a little learning lesson about movies. Would you call that right?
Sure. Yeah. Like recommendations.
Recommendations, that's right. But before we do that, we have one little piece of news that I want to discuss real quickly, if that's all right.
Sure.
All right. Well, we just found out that the Academy has removed a song from the Best Song nomination category.
I was just reading about that while I was waiting for you.
Yeah, I just saw in the Huffington Post, as well as the Hollywood Reporter, that the Academy is removing the song "Alone, Not Yet Alone" from the movie of the same name. And they're, finding out some like frauds with that, because apparently the guy who wrote the song has been apparently emailing members of the branch to make them aware of the submission. Yeah.
Yeah, during the nominations voting period, yeah.
That really is. I don't think this ever happened before.
Actually, it has. Variety posted an article saying something similar happened with The Godfather in 1972. The Academy dropped the nomination for Nino wrote a score because some of the portions in the song were used in an earlier film.
Oh, okay. That's good to know. But I'm actually kind of glad they did drop the song because it was nothing that impressive if you actually heard the song.
I heard it, and you know what? IndieWire posted a tweet like I think an hour ago saying something really mean, like "Thank God they revoked it." I thought that was really mean.
Okay. I guess it could have been in there, but I would much rather have a song from Inside Llewyn Davis.
Haven't seen that movie, but I've heard such great things about it.
Yeah, especially the soundtrack and the fact that it wasn't nominated. I guess what irritates me the most is the fact that they removed the song out of the category, but another one can't replace it.
I think it would be too late at this point, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Oh well. It's such a shame. All right. Well, like we said today for our show, we want to list our top 10 favorite directors, five each, of directors that we think are influential and we're going to talk about one director and the movie that we think is influential. Now, for this list, Christina, do you want to go first, or?
Sure, I'll go first.
Okay, what's your first pick?
Well, firstly, I wouldn't say these are, like, my top five favorite directors. They are certainly, you know, five of my favorite that I, you know, deeply admire and respect and really love their films. But I just picked five that I felt comfortable talking about. So my first one is Sidney Lumet, who many people know directed 12 Angry Men. Dog Day Afternoon, Network, and another one that I really like.
The Wiz. It's The Wiz, right?
The Wiz?
Yeah, he did The Wiz.
Did he?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that one. Oh.
It's not really that good. I mean, because it's got, well, it's got really bad production design, and it's got really bad acting from everyone involved there. It was an off-Broadway play. That worked better as an off-Broadway play than it does as a movie. As a movie, it just kind of fails.
Well, I haven't seen it, so I can't say it for sure.
It's known for just one song, and that's Ease On Down the Road, which is probably the highlight of the whole movie. But it's too dark, and I don't mean that to sound racial at all, because it's an all-black cast. No, I mean, it's like, it's filmed and murky. Yeah, it's just not a good movie, yeah.
Okay, opinion noted. He also did, I just remembered, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Phillips, Seymour Hoffman, I think Ethan Hawke, someone else, I forget. But yeah, director that I really admire and was really sad when he passed a few years ago. But the movie, I think that best reflects, I think, just everything that Sidney Lumet, like if you had to watch one Sidney Lumet film, I would say go with 12 Angry Men. And I know it's an older movie. It's from 1957, but I loved it. It's based on a play. And so immediately, I think people are so turned off by, you know, adaptations from plays, I think, because they're so stagnant. You know, usually there's not a whole lot of editing. There's, you know, a lot of long takes. But it's so... It just involves everything because you watch it and you're just so emotionally captivated by what's going on. So basically, Henry Fonda, he's like a member of this 12-member jury, and he, you know, everyone is like, oh, this guy's guilty. And he ends up convincing, spoiler alert, everyone that he's not. And just the trajectory that the film takes and the journey that it takes to convincing every single member is, I think, mind-blowing. So that's my Sidney Lumet recommendation, 12 Angry Men.
No, and I totally respect that pick as well. All the actors here are really good, and these are actors doing what they do best. It's not easy to watch a movie that just has five people sitting around a table and talking and make it interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think Sidney Lumet does a great job of just making it not only interesting, but also suspenseful.
Yeah.
So, very great pick. And I would add to that, too, Network as well. I think Network is a really great satire about the status of television. And it's weird how that movie was able to eerily predict the way television is today.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, definitely a great pick.
It also has one of the greatest quotes, movie quotes of all time.
I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well, for my first pick, I decided to go with also another kind of classic director, and I decided to pick Billy Wilder for Some Like It Hot. And for me, if you want to go to probably the start, not just, you know, of like classic screwball comedies, but just like just really great lyrical comedies, I'd have to go with Some Like It Hot.
Mm-hmm.
If you like movies, comedies from now, like everything from like Hangover and Superbad, they owe, even Porky's, they owe a lot of, you know, what's the word I'm thinking of here, tribute to Some Like It Hot. And the basic story of Some Like It Hot is with Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis. They play two musicians who witness a crime, and they have to try and get away from the mob. And so they do it by dressing in drag and joining a all-women's, you know, kind of jazz club. And they decided to go on this big kind of cruise out there, and is with Marilyn Monroe. Just really funny. There's a lot of great lines said by Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis in this. It's got the great scene near the end where Tony Curtis and Drake is being chased all around this resort by this guy who doesn't know that he's a guy. It's, every time you watch this movie, you pick up new lines for it. I have not seen this again in a while, though, but every time I do find it on TV, I find myself stopping and watching certain moments of it. It's just, all in all, a really good comedy. And you can definitely see when you watch comedies nowadays, you know, the influences that it had. I mean, it was probably one of the first kind of, like, risque comedies. I wouldn't say raunchy at all, but it does sort of, like, you know, tweets at certain things, at certain morels.
Now, did that one come out before or after The 7-Year Itch?
I want to say before. Yeah, I gotta check that out, actually. But I want to say it came up before.
Yeah, because I think it was, by the time The 7-Year Itch came out, Marilyn Monroe was, like, pretty big. Like, that was the film that, you know, gave her that really iconic moment over the subway ventilation thing, but I think by that point she was already pretty famous.
That's true. I'm researching that right now, actually. And I want to say that it was, you know, Some Like It Hot came out in 59. It came out before. 7 Year Itch came out before that.
Oh, really?
Which I'm... Yeah, in fact, a lot of her big movies came out before Some Like It Hot. But I think Some Like It Hot kind of showed that she could become more of an actress, because after Some Like It Hot, 2 years later, she made The Misfits.
I have not seen that.
Okay. Misfits is supposed to be considered to be one of her, like, you know, big action roles, because it was a dramatic piece for her. Some Like It Hot, she's still being the set symbol, Marilyn Monroe, but she's not the ditzy girl. She's not like the girl from The 7-Year Itch. She's being very... She knows her sexuality and knows how to flaunt it in a way, and tries to act kind of all ditzy, but she really isn't. But yeah, it's a really great movie. Ignore the fact that it is in black and white. Very funny. And I swear, if you're not laughing by the time they're actually... are getting onto the train, then this movie is not going to be for you. But even that last line, you know, where basically, I think it was, yeah, Jack Lemmon takes off the wig, lets the guy know that, hey, look, I'm actually a guy. And the guy turns to him and goes, well, no one's perfect. Still, perfect.
Now, I think it's funny that you picked one of his lighter films, because, you know, Billy Wilder, he's known, I think, more famously for Sunset Boulevard or even Double Indemnity. So do you think he's a better director when he's doing these kind of screwball comedies?
That is a good point right there, because I really love Double Indemnity, and Double Indemnity was going to almost be on the list for me. It's hard to say. How do I word this better? Yeah, that's a good question, because I never really think of it, of him being a better comedy director or of him being a better dramatic director. I will say this, though. I do think that Double Indemnity is a slightly better movie than Some Like It Hot, but it's like apples and oranges. It's hard to compare the two because they're both different genres of movies. And the only other comedy that I've seen from Billy Wilder was The Apartment. Which is also a really great movie with Shirley MacLaine and Jack Lemmon.
Even Sunset Boulevard has comedic moments. I found myself laughing. Like, even when, like, Eric von Stroheim, like, when he shows up and you're like, oh, he's the butler. Like, that was really funny.
It does, and the Boulevard does have some funny moments in there, and it's been a while since I've seen the movie, but for me, it was like more darkly comic moments.
Yeah, it was, yeah, it's like, it's got some dark elements, but I thought there were some funny moments scattered around there. But yeah, you're right. They are, all his films are so different. I think it's unfair to compare.
Yeah, I think that's what makes him a really good director is because he's so prolific and he can do different types of genres and different things from comedies to dramas. Yeah, I definitely need to watch more of his work. I think like the other ones I've seen was Sunset Boulevard, Double Indemnity, The Apartment, and Some Like It Hot.
Yeah.
So,
Well, very diverse director and good choice.
thank you.
Okay, my second pick, I'm gonna pick a more contemporary director, and I'm gonna go with Christopher Nolan, because I was a fan of his even before the Batman series, and I know, his name, he's so famous now because of, the Batman franchise and then Inception, which I don't think would have ever gone made without, without having made the Batman films, to financially support, such a huge movie like that. But I want to go back to his early days and talk about Memento, which came out in 2000. And if you have not seen Memento, I want you to listen to this whole podcast, and as soon as it's over, watch it. It's one of my favorites because the movie is so unconventional in terms of the plot. It's told backwards. So Guy Pearce, he plays this guy who has like short-term memory loss, and he has tattoos all over his body. So whenever he has a short-term memory loss, he will look at it, like his arm or a part of his body, and he'll see a tattoo, and that'll be a clue to solving a mystery, which is his wife's murder. But the whole film is told backwards. So I think that right there should get you to watch it.
And not only that, too, it's interesting that the main plot line is told backwards, but all the flashbacks are done forward. They're done in chronological order. And what I really liked about this movie is that they don't just do, the story backwards. They do the filmmaking backwards, because even the very first frame is a picture that suddenly dissolves back into the camera. And that sort of sets off the mystery right there, because you see this picture of this bloody guy, and the picture starts to fade away, then the photo goes back inside the camera, and suddenly you're at the last scene of the movie, and you're totally confused about what happens. And not only are you confused about what happens there, but it does put you in the same mind, the same mind as the main character, because he has short memory loss, so he can only remember things at a time. And when the movie's done backwards, you tend to forget things. I think I showed this film. I think I showed a scene of this film for a film class I was taking once, and it was the scene where how to start this here. He is trying to find a pen to write something down, and Carrie Ann Moss's character comes in, and she says, "All right, Dodd. Dodd just hit me." And he's like, "Well, who's Dodd? Well, you should know who he is." And so he has to go and find out this Dodd guy because he attacked Carrie Ann Moss's character. But it goes into the scene before that. She comes in and starts making fun of him. And it's like, "All right, you can't remember shit. You're not going to help me out here." And she says, "All right, well, I'm going to use you. I'm going to use you, all right? And I'm going to just call your wife, And he starts calling his wife's like a name, like she's a dumb cunt and everything. And he hits her. And she walks away, and then when she comes back in, she says, and when she comes back in, right before that, he loses memory and asks, "Well, what happened?" And she says, "Well, Dot hit me." And yeah, I don't think I'm explaining it that well, but
It's kind of confusing to explain for people who haven't seen it.
it is. But yeah, it's just you, if you're a fan of definitely the Batman movies and you are a fan of Inception, you definitely have to see this movie. And I'm really ashamed that this movie did not win for Best Original Screenplay.
Yeah, it was written by Nolan, Christopher Nolan, and his brother Jonathan.
Based on the his like short story they did.
Yeah, Memento Mori.
Now, I don't know, but on the special edition DVD, there's a feature to watch the movie in chronological order.
Oh, I did not know that.
You gotta go with like the special feature menu, and then there's some sort of code you have to type in, and you can actually watch the movie in chronological order.
Have you seen it in chronological order?
I have, and it's interesting to watch if you've seen the movie before. It's as a fun little experiment, but if you're watching this for the first time, you gotta watch it the way it's supposed to be seen. Yeah.
Okay. I might check that out.
But yeah, no, definitely good choice. What do you think about the Prestige?
The Prestige. I think, you know what? I think I saw Memento right after I saw The Prestige because I remember watching it in theaters and I was like, oh my God, who is this guy? Christopher Nolan. I gotta check out all his movies. I really liked it, yeah.
Okay, very cool. All right, well, solid pick, Memento, Nolan. Great pick. All right, well, for my second pick, I also decided to go and do something a little bit more modern, and that is Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing.
I was so mad when you told me that you picked that because that was going to be one of my top five.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's good. We have things in common there. That's awesome. But Do the Right Thing is a movie that came out in 1989. It stars Lee himself, along with Danny Aiello, Ruby Dee. Gosh, I'm blanking on that guy's name. The guy who plays one of his sons. Why can I not remember the guy's name now?
I can't remember his name either now.
Oh, John Turturro.
Yeah.
That John Turturro. But it's 24 hours in the lives of this New York neighborhood during the hottest time of the year. And it's a story about racial tension, and a lot of people seem to think that this movie is basically racist and it just basically plays to one side, but I don't really feel that way at all. Basically, there's a Danny Aiello plays a Italian guy who opens up a pizza shop in this probably all black neighborhood.
Yeah.
But not only that too, there's Asians and it's the whole melting pot of different races coming together. And the tension starts to build and build until it finally explodes in this like racial tension. And a lot of people have commented saying that, well, it's obviously, who caused this problem there. I mean, it's really obviously Mooty for throwing the garbage can through there, through the window. And some people say it was due to the fact that the cops killed someone. But I think this movie is, it's. I think this movie can be somewhat uplifting in a way, just the fact that we can learn from watching this and make our living situations a better thing. We don't have to actually act like these people. I think one of the best sequences in the movie is when each different race, talks about
Oh,
another race.
they break the fourth wall and they speak directly to the camera.
Yes, that one. I almost like feel like this is the movie that we should show people who are coming into America what America is. I mean, there are some ugly things, there's some beautiful things. A lot of people seem to think that the Danny Aiello character is a racist, and I never thought that at all. I didn't really think any of the characters in this movie are actually racist. They may talk about race, they may address certain races. I don't think that makes them an actual racist.
I think what Lee was trying to bring up was that, everyone has these kind of thoughts because, that scene that you talk about where everyone speaks directly to the camera and spurs like racial epithets, that was kind of like externalizing everyone's point of view towards every other race. So I think he was saying it's not just one group of people being racist, it's everyone towards everyone. Yeah, and the ending, the fact that there are so many interpretations as to who was responsible and who's guilty and who should be blamed, I think that's so beautiful that a film can spur that kind of dialogue between people and there's no set answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the fact that he has two juxtaposing quotes at the end, one by Malcolm X, who, you know, believed in fighting for what you wanted and using violence if you thought it was necessary to defend yourself, and Dr. King, who obviously advocated, you know, nonviolence. The fact that he has those two opposing quotes, I think, sort of puts responsibility on us as the audience as to what is the right choice, you know?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Got a killer soundtrack. Mm-hmm. When this came out, Public Enemy was on my wall everywhere. I had their shirts, so I was very excited to have them on the soundtrack. But yeah, it's one of those movies too. It should have been up for an Academy Award, and I really wish it wasn't. And I think it wasn't due to the fact that there was so much controversy about it, though. Mm-hmm. I think the only thing it did get nominated for was for Best Screenplay and Best Supporting Actor.
For Lee?
Yeah, for Lee got nominated for Best Supporting for Best Writing, and Danielle got nominated for Best Actor. Oh, best supporting actor.
Okay. See, I think this film should get nominated for an Oscar every year.
Okay.
It's only fair.
Just re-release it every year.
Yeah.
I totally agree with that. But yeah, that's my second choice there. Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. I think Spike Lee has had a pretty prolific career as well. Not so much recently. I think after Do the Right Thing, he did a movie called Crooklyn.
I love Crooklyn.
All right, yep. I haven't seen that one yet.
It was really good. I think it's one of his best.
Really?
Do the Right Thing, Crooklyn, and oh my god.
You're gonna say No Better Blues?
No. School Days.
Oh, School it Days.
Top three films.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, sweet. Also liked the Malcolm X.
I liked it too, but it was so long. It took me like all day to watch it because I kept taking breaks.
I think one of his best newer movies that was out was 25th Hour.
I haven't seen that one.
That's a good one. Inside Man.
I liked Inside Man.
Inside Man was really good. Have you seen his new Old Boy?
I have not, no.
Okay, I haven't either, but I am kind of curious about what he did with that. A movie that most people don't like of his, but I did enjoy, was Bamboozled.
I've heard so much about it from, like, my film professor saying that it was really bad, so I'm, like, debating whether I should watch it or not.
You should still give it a shot there, because it is essentially, it is sort of like a satire of like network television, because Damon Wayans plays this TV executive who doesn't wait, he thinks that TV shows' focuses on black people are incredibly racist anyways, and he's trying to get fired from his job, so he decides to release a minstrel show with black people in blacker faces to try and get fired. But it turns out to be a bigger hit than he expected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's all kind of shot in digital video, too, so it's got that going for it.
I heard the woman, I'm blanking on her name, who did the cinematography, like, really effed up.
Oh, okay.
Like, she just, it was, like, way too overexposed or something.
Oh, I see. I thought that was just kind of the style of that one, but I had no idea that she was messed up here. Yeah, Ellen Kuras.
Ellen Kuras, yeah.
All right. Well, very good to know. Very cool. So what's number three for you?
Okay, number three hopefully is not a new name that I'm mentioning and everyone knows who this guy is. It's David Lynch. And out of all of his family-oriented films...
Well, you did have one family-oriented film.
Which one?
The Straight Story.
I haven't seen that one.
It's a Disney movie.
Really?
Yeah, it's a Walt Disney. It says Walt Disney presents a David Lynch film.
Are you lying?
No, I'm not lying at all. It's a Walt Disney picture. It's with Richard Farnsworth. It's about the guy who has a tractor going to visit his brother.
What the? Okay, well, I'll have to check that out some other time.
Okay.
Anyway, so the movie I picked is not a Disney movie, kids. It's Mulholland Drive. And I was kind of, like, teeter-tottering back and forth between picking Mulholland Drive and Eraserhead, But I thought, you know, most people probably wouldn't be able to sit through Eraserhead and not come out, like, really fucked up afterwards. So I'll go with Mulholland Drive. I love David Lynch because I think he sort of mixes independent film and avant-garde, because his films, they have a narrative, so they're not, like, totally avant-garde, but if you watch them, you'll know they kind of are, because they're almost like if I were to describe David Lynch's style to someone who has not been exposed to any of his films, I would say imagine it like a dream. You know, things just happen, and it seems like there's nothing connecting, you know, all the elements together. And I think Mulholland Drive is kind of like that, because if you try to, you know, put it in chronological order and piece it together, the pieces don't fit. Like, I've talked about this with other people in film classes, and my professor was saying that people have, like, gone really upset because they've tried to piece it together, you know, the story, in chronological order, and it just, David Lynch, just, his mind doesn't work that way. So I like it because it goes against convention, you know, because you expect a story, you expect it to be a certain way and to, you know, tell a story from, you know, beginning, middle, and end, or at least be able to go back and go, okay, this is the beginning, this is the middle, and this is the end. But with this film, well, basically what it's about, Naomi Watts' character, she moves out to Hollywood to try to become an actress, and she meets a woman who has amnesiac, like she, or no, wait.
Well, yeah, I know, because the woman that she meets was in a car accident, and she doesn't know who she is. And the two become sleuths, and they're trying to piece together her identity. And that part is pretty straightforward. You know, Naomi Watts is this actress. She's living at her aunt's house. Is going into an audition. And they're trying to find out who she is. There's one scene where basically after they make the girl who is an amnesiac, who is Laura Ellen, Laura Harren Elena, hope I'm saying that name right. Yeah, Laura Harren. They go to this club, they get this box, and then suddenly she disappears. And this is where the film becomes really confusing. I've seen this movie going on now like 6 times, and I still can't grasp the mystery. And I still think that's the fun of the movie, is trying to piece together the mystery. I know a lot of people will become kind of frustrated that they can't figure this movie out right away, but it is kind of a joy trying to pick out like certain nuggets here and there and certain little clues. Because like what Christina said, the story, the movie essentially is a dream. And it kind of goes back and forth between being in a real world and a dream world. But unlike most movies where you know if it's a dream or it isn't a dream, this movie doesn't tell you. It just gives you certain little clues that will tell you if you're in the dream world or you're not in the dream world. I will give you one little insider hint in the movie, okay? There is a scene towards the end of the movie where Naomi Watts' character is in her little bungalow apartment right there, and she is alone, and there's like a little ashtray that's on the table, and she goes away, comes back, and I think the ashtray is gone, but Laura Harren's character appears. So that's how a little hint there, you can know if it's a dream or not, if that ashtray is there or isn't there. And I'm not quite sure if the ashtray is there, then it's a dream, or if it's taken away, it's not. I don't really know the exact details of that.
What I've heard people say, like, in order to figure out if you're dreaming or not, like, while you're dreaming, look at something, and then turn around, and then turn back, and if it's gone, then you're dreaming.
Oh. Okay. I did not know about that. I'm still trying to figure out the deal with the little guy in the chair, who makes phone calls to people. I don't know exactly what the Cowboys connection is.
I don't know either.
This movie does have a very funny sequence with Billy Ray Cyrus.
Oh, yeah.
Billy Ray Cyrus and Justin Theroux. Okay, so another side story of this, Justin Theroux plays this movie director who is cast in the lead for his new movie, and the producers want him to cast this other girl, and he is refusing to do it. So, you know, they take away all of his money, they basically give him nothing, his girlfriend leaves him for Billy Ray Cyrus' character, and he goes to their house and tries to destroy jewelry, and he attacks him. And then the mobsters, and trying to find Justin Theroux's character, go to his house to try and find him. And the girlfriend jumps on the mobster's back, and he's this really big, huge, 200-pound guy. And this little scrawny girl is trying to climb on the guy, punching him and beating him and saying, "He's not here, he's not here." And Billy Ray Cyrus tries to come out and knock the dude out. But the dude's a lot bigger than him. He just takes one big punch and just knocks the dude out cold. And then he just goes, Adam Kessler. I don't know why I brought that moment up there, but that just moment just stuck in my head for some reason.
I think every moment sticks in my head.
Yeah, the movie has tons of like really great scenes, and if you don't really understand the story of it, you can still really enjoy the scenery of it. I like the songs they used. Those like 50s, you know, kind of doo-wop songs, because it makes it kind of a creepy.
Yeah, he uses a lot of those type of songs in all of his films.
In Blue Velvet there too. Yeah, just I don't know.
Orbison, yeah.
Mm-hmm. While it hurts, would you say that after people watch Mulholland Drive, they should go back and watch Eraserhead, or should they watch some of his other movies before that?
That's exactly what I did. I watched Mulholland Drive, and then I think the next film of his that I watched was Eraserhead.
Okay. See, I kind of went back. Well, for David Lynch movies, I think the first movie I saw of his was Lost Highway.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back and watched Wild at Heart, and then Blue Velvet, mm-hmm. And then I watched Dune, and then I went back and watched Eraserhead.
I think if you're new to David Lynch, you should watch Blue Velvet first, because okay. I think that one has a more clear narrative to follow.
It definitely does. It still has the surrealism and the absurdities of his other movies, but it is a little bit more easier to understand. Brief synopsis of Blue Velvet. Colin McLaughlin is a kid coming home from college for a weekend. He mm-hmm. discovers a human ear on the field, and while he investigates this human ear, it brings him to the seedy side of his idyllic, you know, Norman Rockwell type town.
Mm-hmm.
So,
dark nature of suburbia.
Exactly. Dennis Hopper is really good and a very scary performance.
So creepy. It's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And the song that was seen by Harry Dean Stanton.
Oh, I don't remember.
He sings a song by Roy Orbison.
Oh, yeah.
Candy colored clown, they call us Sandman.
Yeah.
Wizards through my window every night. All right, I'm going to stop. Sorry. But yeah, great, great choice for Mulholland Drive. Love it. David Lynch, Mulholland Drive. Definitely check out his other movies if you get a chance to. He's not doing much movies now, which kind of irritates me.
Didn't he retire? He's like, fuck this. I'm going to direct music videos.
Yeah, he's doing music now. He released another new album.
Yeah. He was on the last season of Louie, which I thought was awesome.
Really?
Yeah, you haven't seen it? He plays I won't tell you because you haven't seen it, but yeah, he's in the last season for like 2 episodes.
Oh,
really
nice.
Funny.
Must be later episodes. Okay, cool. I'll definitely have to check that out.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so for my third pick here, I decided to go with a little bit of an older director. Not too much. He's still making movies now. In fact, the dude makes a movie every year, and I think he'll continue to do so until he dies. And that's Woody Allen. And the movie that I feel is probably the most influential of Mr. Allen's is the one that he won Best Picture for, and that's Annie Hall. Everything that you know about romantic comedies, everything that you love about romantic comedies is basically through this movie. And it's hard for me to pick really just one Woody Allen movie, because the guy makes tons of movies, and seriously, I could probably pick any movie of his list right there. But I mainly picked Annie Hall, just basically the way he describes about relationships. I do like the quote at the end of the movie, is he tells a joke, and the joke is basically this. Guy goes to a doctor, and he says, "Doctor, we need help. My brother thinks he's a chicken." And the doctor goes, "So, why don't you have him committed?" And the guy goes, "Well, I would, but I need the eggs." And he goes on to later say, and that's how basically we feel about relationships. They're wild and they're crazy. They don't make much sense, but in the end, we go through it because, well, we all need the eggs. This one, Best Picture, Best Actress, Diane Keaton, Best Screenplay. Yeah, it's a very just beautiful movie. Story is about this neurotic comedian played by Woody Allen and his on-again, off-again relationship with Annie Hall. But not only does it go through their relationship, it goes through his other past relationships with other women and what was working about them, what didn't work. I like the fact that this movie kind of shows both the good sides and the bad sides of the relationships. I think this is, for me, probably one of the best romantic comedies next to something like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. To kind of show you, like, you know, both sides of the equations. It's extremely funny. Not for me, just being a Woody Allen fan. I think the picture itself is just funny. I like the beginning sequences when he's describing his childhood. There's a great scene where he's in a classroom, and apparently he makes a move on another girl. And the girl stops and talks to him. Basically, it's Woody Allen. He's actually in the classroom talking to, like, the younger version of himself. And the younger girl turns around and says to him, and I'm not going to quote it right here, so don't take my word for example there for sure. But she basically says, "Come on, Alvy, even Freud had a latency period. Well, I never had one. I can't help it."
I do remember that scene. And that's a really great pick. I love Danny Hall. And it's really funny. I love Diane Keaton. And they dated for a while. And you could tell they just had such amazing chemistry. Because they worked with each other for quite a few films, quite a few of his films. And I think it shows. But you're right. He's always talking about his relationships, and he's so self-deprecating when he talks about himself, and he's so honest. And it's so, like, you really, like, pity him, but at the same time, you empathize with him, because it's like, oh, yeah, that reminds me of, you know, something that happened to me. Because he's so, I think, he's, to me, one of the most existential directors ever. You know, he doesn't believe in religion, he doesn't believe in God, and he's so open about it, and I think that's just so inviting, you know, because you almost look at his films as like little tiny vignettes into his own life and little tiny biographies, and you feel like you get to know him, and his films are so, they just seem so personal, and anyhow, that's a great pick.
Yeah, definitely. And apparently before this movie got released, it was going to be a lot longer. I think the original title of this movie was Aledonia, which is – I'm not seeing the terminology right for that, and I apologize, but it's the fear of, like, being close or being touched. And it essentially was going to be – well, it was going to be this, like, this really kind of longer, almost like three-hour-long movie, but I guess the producers had him cut down to the 90-minute length, and that's how we got Annie Hall. Because apparently do you remember the movie Manhattan Murder Mystery?
Was that a Woody Allen film?
It's a Woody Allen movie with him and Diane Keaton, where they discovered someone in the apartment complex has died, and they accuse one of their neighbors of killing them, and they try to be like, and Diane Keaton's character becomes obsessed about it, about the mystery going on.
I haven't seen that one, though. No.
Well, that story was originally going to be in Annie Hall. To make it, like, that much longer, or something about, like, their neighbors passing away earlier, and they're accusing a neighbor about it, so, but, yeah.
Did you know that Woody Allen writes all of his scripts on a typewriter?
I heard about that.
The typewriter he's had for, like, ever.
That's amazing. That's really cool. Yeah. I saw you watch that documentary.
I did, yeah, that's what I was referring to.
Oh yeah, yep, very cool. Yeah, he erased all of his story ideas in little notepads. Yeah. So I hope he continues to make more movies. I really enjoyed his last movie, Blue Jasmine. But yeah, if you have to start with a Woody Allen movie, I would say start with Annie Hall. If you're not a fan of Woody Allen because of his persona there, I have to start with the Purple Rose of Cairo.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Which is a really great movie. Based story about Purple Rose of Cairo is about a woman played by Mia Farrow set in the Depression area. And she goes to the same movie all the time because she's not being appreciated by her husband, played by Danny Aiello. And during one time at the movies, one of her favorite characters comes off of the screen and starts up a conversation, and they start going out. And while that's happening, the real actor, also played by Jeff Daniels, comes to town to try to get him back on the screen.
Yeah, I think that was an homage to Buster Keaton, because he did that in one of his films where he goes into the film. He plays like a projectionist at a film theater, and then I think he has a dream where he, you know, goes into the film through the screen.
Yes, Sherlock Jr.
Yeah.
Is what it was. Oh, yep, very good, very good. But yep, that's, I know I kind of went over the place there with Woody Allen, but yeah, Woody Allen, Annie Hall, any of his movies, good choices, is my number three.
I would say start with Midnight in Paris if you're new to Woody Allen.
Definitely a good choice.
Yeah. Okay, so I agree, good choice. My number four pick will be Spike Jonze, another contemporary director. He's he just recently released Her, which was his fourth major motion picture, followed by Where the Wild Things Are, being John Malkovich, and my pick, which is Adaptation. This was, I can't remember if I saw Adaptation first or being John Malkovich, but I just remember watching Adaptation, and it's like one of those films that you're watching and you're like, oh my god, I can't believe this is a movie and I didn't watch it sooner. But basically, it's about this character played by Nicolas Cage, and he plays two roles. He plays Charlie Kaufman and Donald Kaufman. And interesting tidbit, Charlie Kaufman is one of the screenwriters. He's like a real person, but he sort of creates this more fictionalized, more demented version of himself in the film. So Nicolas Cage, he plays two characters, twins, and he's a screenwriter. And he gets this book called, I think it's called like The Orchid Thief. And I think it's written by Meryl Streep's character. And she, you know, basically writes this book about orchids. And then Nicolas Cage's character tries to adapt it into a screenplay. And just the whole process of him, because he's so, I would even compare his character to one of Woody Allen's characters, because he's so neurotic and he's like nervous and anxious and sweating all the time. And then his brother Donald is just the complete opposite. He's confident and he decides, oh, well, I'm going to be a screenwriter too. And he goes to like this, you know, become a screenwriter in like 24 steps kind of meeting things. And he writes like this amazing, well, it's not an amazing script, but he writes the script and he gets like a deal right away, and Charlie gets really jealous. Anyway, it's a really funny movie, very self-reflexive of the medium, really funny. Charlie Kaufman, he also did the screenplay for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. So if you've seen that, you liked it. I think this is a must-see.
Yeah, I can totally piggyback everything you just said right there about the movie. Honestly, this is one I have not revisited in quite a long time, and I feel bad about that. After being John Malkovich, I was a big fan of wanting to see this movie. I do like the way this story goes. It's something that when you watch it, you feel like you know where the story is going, and then it will completely change things around.
Yeah.
And I will say this, though. This is probably one of the best Nicolas Cage performances since, I will say, Leaving Las Vegas or Kick-Ass.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, this shows that if you give an actor good material, you know, he'll do a good job. And I know a lot of people like to, you know, crap on Nick Cage and say, oh, the guy has just basically become a joke. But I still think Nick Cage can be a good actor if you just give him the right material.
I'm always rooting for actors like that. Like, a few years ago, I was talking to a friend, and they're like, oh, Matthew McConaughey, I hate him. I'm like, hate him. He's like, he hasn't even done his best work. You just wait. And now she's eating her words.
That's right. I will say the same thing will probably happen to him again. You know, but everyone else in this movie is good. Meryl Streep does a really good job in this performance as well. Maggie Gyllenhaal, who plays Donald's love interest, is good. It's got my favorite actress, Tilda Swinton.
Oh, yeah. She plays an agent.
Yeah,
or
one of his agents, yeah.
Yeah. Chris Cooper, who actually won Best Supporting Actor.
That's right, he did. Very good. I totally forgot about that.
If you watch Being John Malkovich, you will get the Being John Malkovich reference in the film where they sort of, he's working on the set of Being John Malkovich is what I'm trying to say.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just about to reference that right there, but then it's like, nope, damn it, Vern. Yep, that's my words. Bam. Sweet. That's all I had to say about the movies, the Being John Malkovich references. So, yeah, and with the recent release of Her, I think that Spike Jonze will continue to be a really great director. I was really worried, too, that he was going to write his own screenplays, but he's shown to be a great screenwriter, a great director. I'm excited to see more movies for him. So, definitely adaptations, Spike Jonze, check out any of his movies, any of his short films, music videos. Yeah, the guy is a visual artist, I would say.
Yeah, and I think that's why so many people admire him and, you know, so many actors want to work with him, because even though he hasn't made that many films, they're all so good. Everyone can't wait for the next one.
Mm-hmm. All right. Very cool. All right. We only have a couple more left here. Actually, so my next one on my list, and we'll be really brief about this one, is Quentin Tarantino. Quentin Tarantino has always been known as the Uber movie geek. He was a guy who worked at a video store for a long time and didn't go to college, and suddenly he made a movie called Reservoir Dogs. That's a big hit, and everyone loves it. Then he gets a lot of money to make his next feature, and I still say that this is one of his most influential films, Pulp Fiction, released in 1995. If you don't know the story by now, you are not at all a film fan. If you don't know about Pulp Fiction, I'm not going to even explain to you about Pulp Fiction, because you should know the name Pulp Fiction. You should know Quentin Tarantino. So I'm not going to do any plot synopsis of the movie. But every movie that came out since Pulp Fiction has been kind of a ripoff of Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction sort of populated the whole importance of dialogue. Even in the script for Pulp Fiction, the scene with Pumpkin and Honey Bunny, he writes in the notes that they're talking fast, like His Girl Friday. And the way that he plays – now, people say that Quentin Tarantino does rips off of other movies, and I will disagree. I think he plays homages to different movies. And Pulp Fiction has movies from the 50s, movies from the 70s. It's just got all this big collage of different style of movies into one. Pulp Fiction is the movie that made me interested in other films. Pulp Fiction was the first movie I knew about something called Letterboxd. I had no clue that films are cropped down to fit your TV before. Pulp Fiction got me interested in foreign films. It got me interested in art house films. It was a gateway drug for me. And it was a movie that me and my friends watched constantly all the time. And I think my friends were watching it because, you know, they liked the funny scenes and the dialogue. But I was starting to see something a little bit more. And then when I got the special edition DVD, there was a trivia track. And on the trivia track, it goes through and it will tell you specifically the different references of film that was used in that movie.
That film just has like every, because I wrote an essay on this film like a year or two ago, and it has like every single genre of film in it. Like, it has so many genres. It's like a Western, it's like a samurai film, it's like a romantic comedy. It's, yeah.
It's got a musical number in there too. It's just like the whole kitchen
sink. A musical, yeah.
And then some.
It's like a hodgepodge of like different genres and different kind of films.
I think for a movie that's, it's influential because it does influence a bunch of other older movies, and then I feel like a lot of newer movies since then seem to try to recapture that same sort of vibe, especially in the mid-90s. The mid-90s, they seem to be like a bunch of those movies being released.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to say anything more about Pulp Fiction, because if you haven't heard of it before, then you're not a movie fan. I'm sorry, I don't want to be rude, but you, yeah.
I think we could spend like a whole podcast just talking about Pulp Fiction.
We could, I know. But let's move on and hear about your next pick.
Okay, my last pick is a director who I've loved for years, since high school. He was one of the directors who I found during my high school years, and I just, for whatever reason, really connected with his films. And it's Darren Aronofsky, who I just read the trailer for his new film, Noah, is going to be released during the Super Bowl. But the film that I picked was Requiem for a Dream, because it is, I mean, if you haven't seen it, it's pretty intense. Like, it was intense for me. I think I watched it when I was like 14 or 15, and it like emotionally, mentally scarred me. I was like, oh my God, I'm never doing drugs ever, ever.
I watched this one with my dad.
Oh, I watched it by myself and I regretted it. But yeah, it's about four different people and their, I guess, their choice of drugs, you know, whatever that may be for them, and basically how their lives parallel each other through, you know, their drug use, and how they just it. Like, in the beginning, they have dreams, you know, the mom has dreams of being on television, the son, you know, the son and his girlfriend, they, you know, want to open, like, a clothing store together, and then their friend, he wants to, you know, stop dealing drugs, and I think he just wants to, like, make his mother proud, and it's basically how drugs shatter that dream. And if you want to watch it for any reason, like, if you're interested in editing, watch this film. The editing is so amazing. Like, I mean, the use of like fisheye lens, split screen, fast cutting, you know, the use of effects to, you know, externalize and illustrate, you know, them under that influence is really amazing.
Yeah, those scenes right there, they sort of like represent the sort of need for the drug and then the relief afterwards. And then after that, yeah. The loneliness, the emptiness of it.
Yeah.
And I kind of saw this movie more not just being about drug use, but about any type of addiction, any type of dream chasing. I mean, Ellen Burstyn's character.
Even love, just being in love.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a drug.
And the whole need to chase that dream and trying to fill it with anything else. For the mother, mm-hmm. it's television. For the kids, it's drugs. It's just trying to fill that hole. And if you just keep feeding that hole is going to get bigger and bigger, like it does with Jared Leto's arm in the movie.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
No, that scene turned my stomach inside out. I did not eat for hours after that.
Oh, the whole thing does. And it, like Requiem, it keeps building and building until the final 15 minutes, probably the last 10 minutes of the movie, is just this montage of sounds and images cut together. And I do remember watching this with my dad, because I'm like, hey, my dad got free screeners and movies. I'm like, Dad, Requiem for a Dream. Can we watch this? Had no idea what I was in store for. And we sat there and we watched the movie and we're enjoying the visuals of it and we're enjoying the sound. And my dad's like, well, this is getting cool. All right. And then right after Jared Leto visits his mother and she has that tearful confession, and I'm still kind of pissed off that the Academy did not recognize her as being Best Actress just for that one scene alone. After Ellen Burstyn has that tearful, you know, confession to her son, that's when the movie gets really kind of dark and no one just said a word. Like, me and my dad just sat there in complete silence, watched it towards the very end, after everything was over with, movie ended, we just sat there in silence, and I think it was so quiet there, we can still feel or hear each other's heartbeats, which is kind of weird, but I can still feel my heart beating, and my dad looked at me and goes, "Whoa, wow, what in the world did we just watch?" And I'm like, I apologize, Dad, next time we'll do another fun action movie, but just completely floored me. And I put this movie as my number two favorite movie of all time. I try to watch this movie at least once every couple months. Just, yeah, I'm blown away by the performances. Everyone does good in this movie. Jennifer Connelly, Marlon Wayans, who's mainly known for being a comedic actor, does a really good job and dramatic role in this. Clint Mansell does the score with the Cronos Quartet. Yeah, just beautiful. Great, great pick, Christina.
Yeah, one of my favorite scores, too. If you're a film score buff, definitely check out this film for Clint Mansell.
It's one of those scores that was used in a bunch of other movies, but it's used much better here. So
yes, I agree.
Definitely a good choice with, Requiem for a Dream, Darren Aronofsky. Any of his movies are good choices, so you can't go wrong with starting with any of them. But you got to watch one. Watch Requiem for a Dream. It's the first collaboration between him and Jennifer Connelly, so now they're going to be working together in Noah, so that's awesome. Mm-hmm. All right, so my last pick of the night is Stanley Kubrick and 2001: A Space Odyssey. I know, very kind of cliche answer to say, oh, Stanley Kubrick, everyone chooses Stanley Kubrick, oh boy. But you have to understand that before Stanley Kubrick made 2001: A Space Odyssey, we have not actually seen what space looked like. I mean, most movies that were made at that time were kind of cheesy monster movies or little flying saucers on strings coming down. We did not actually know what space looked like. And what he did with writer Arthur C. Clarke is to tell a very accurate representation of what space travel would look like. Everything moves slow because not much gravity out there. And the way he sets the scenes in space to Strauss's The Blue Danube is a very incredible, moving visual. I like the way the fact that, there's that one, I guess you call her stewardess, and she's walking up the walls on the ceiling right there, everything floats. It's a story that doesn't become a story until later on. It's very, I would say, almost confusing, and I can understand why people would get turned off by this movie a little bit, because it just starts off with a bunch of these apes, and then they see this black monolith, and suddenly they know how to use their bones as tools, and then it jumps cuts millions of years later to people in space, and these two guys have to go on this mission to discover this new form of life and everything. And the suspenseful part happens probably in the third act of the movie. But from this movie here, it, like I said before, it helped start the space revolution, because a year or so after this movie came out is when we actually did go up in space.
Now, I'm going to have to ask you about that. Do you know about the controversy about the whole, filming in space and Kubrick and how he was involved with that?
Oh, the whole faking of the moon landing thing? Yes, yeah. I watched The Room 237, and I really don't believe it. I mean, no.
You don't believe it, or you don't believe that Kubrick could be so fastidious and plant all those little devices for us to catch?
I don't think he would do that, though, because if Stanley Kubrick was to, fake something like the moon landing, I think he wants someone to know about it. He's like, look what I did. I made this really cool movie. You should know about it.
I think he had people, watching him closely. If he did do it, fake the moon landing, he wouldn't have been able to talk about it.
Maybe not. Yeah, I don't. It seems almost plausible, but then if you actually looked at the real pictures of space, I don't know. Yeah, maybe. I guess at this point now, it doesn't really matter. We're already been space already, so I guess it doesn't really matter now if we did fit the moon lander or not, because we actually know what space looks like. So a little crappy black and white photography of space doesn't compare to what we have now. So if we did, fine. I don't care. You know, let the man rest in peace. You know, good for him, I'll say.
Okay.
But yeah, 2001. Stanley Kubrick is not a prolific director, and he only makes movies every 5 or 7 years, compared to, like, you know, Woody Allen, who does a movie every year. Stanley Kubrick, every 5 or 7 years, he'll pop on a movie. And Stanley Kubrick is known for being very detailed in all of his movies, and he's the guy known for doing tons upon tons of takes with all of his movies. That's why they take so
Yeah.
long to get made. But yeah, 2001, I know a lot of people will probably put, you know, Clockwork Orange or The Shining on the list, and those are all very great movies. But just the fact that 2001: A Space Odyssey helped influence space travel, and maybe he did fake the moon landing, so it's got that controversy, you know, benefit in the movie as well.
Yeah, I think the reason some people might be turned off is because the film is mostly silent. But if you're enamored by filmic, pictures and stuff like that, I think you'd really get a kick out of it.
Right. Are you not a big fan of this movie, or?
No, I really like this movie. I
Okay.
think I would have gone. I think, what you said in the beginning, just because I think everyone would expect an answer like this, I think I would have gone with Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, yeah. Okay. No,
I love Peter Sellers, and I think he's hilarious in that film. But no, I do like 2001.
I can't fault you at all. Dr. Strangelove, that movie is hysterically funny.
Yeah.
The scenes he has with the President of France on the phone, just comic gold. Yes, folks, Stanley Kubrick has made an incredibly funny movie. Dr. Strangelove, I know most people think of, well, Stanley Kubrick, Clockwork Orange, Shining, those movies aren't really funny. What the hell? But yeah, no, Dr. Strangelove, just very incredibly funny.
One of my favorite quotes of all time is in that movie, too.
Well, you can't fight in here, this is the war room.
Yeah.
Yes. But yeah, you know, all in all, you know, good list of directors, and there's probably, you know, a lot more we can discuss, and we'll have to do another one of these, you know, soon, because there were a lot of directors that we wanted to include on this list, but we had to take them off for time reasons. So we'll definitely have, you know, a few episodes down the road, we'll have another one of these.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, but I think it's about that time, folks, to sort of end this episode of Silver Screen Speak Podcast. Do you have any closing thoughts at all?
Nope.
All right. You can definitely check out our, you know, shows at Silver Screen Speak dot Podomatic.com. We'll have a website eventually soon, just not right now, mainly because I've been working and I really haven't had much time to put one together, but we will shortly, as well as a Twitter page. But you can definitely find me at Video Vanguard on Twitter. And where can people find you, Christina?
At Aftercut Reviews.
Okay. Very cool. You can also check out this episode. We'll post on, you know, one of our websites. My website is The Video Vortex, www.videovortex.wordpress.com. And can you tell the listeners the name of your site again, Christina?
Yes, I have two blogs you can visit. One is christinalule.blogspot.com, and my other one, my new one, at WordPress, thoughtsofadyingcinephile.wordpress.com.
All right, very cool. And I should mention too, yes, you can still find me at Video Vanguard, VanGaurd.com. But we're gonna close the show right now. Thank you everyone for listening to us. Please leave comments on this episode, and they will be read on a future one. So good night, everybody. We love you all.
Bye.
Don't speak. Please don't speak. Please don't speak. No, no, no. Go. Go, gentle Scorpio, go. Your Pisces wishes you every happy return.